The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, welcome, everybody. Welcome, everybody, to this week's Capital Thinking. We've got a good show for you. We're going to talk about a couple of current events going on Capitol Hill, the immigration vote scheduled for later today, the frantic 12th-hour efforts to get a deal done on student loans, extending the interest rate on student loans. We're going to talk about a recent Supreme Court decision. But we're going to start off abroad by talking a little bit about foreign investment, what's going on in capital markets in the Middle East. Joining us is an associate from the Riyadh office of Patton Boggs, Jihad Turkestani. Jihad specializes in corporate law and Islamic finance and litigation in the areas of trade, capital markets, finance, and general commercial law. And he's here to talk to us a little bit today about new rules issued by an entity called the Saudi Arabian General Investment Authority that have to do with contracting activities in the Saudi market. So welcome to the show, and tell us a little bit about SAGIA and what their role is in the nation of Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia, in the year of 2000, enacted a foreign investment law as part of its change in its policy towards foreign investments, where such a law allowed foreign investors to come into the kingdom and invest and have the same protections that national and Saudi investors would have. Now, as part of that policy, the implementation of the foreign investment law, which was given to this government entity called the Saudi Arabian General Investment Authority, or as we call in Saudi Arabia, SAGIA. SAGIA has been there since the year of 2000 and has been the regulator of foreign investors. It had also the task of bringing in foreign investors to the kingdom, and make sure that foreign investments will participate in the development of the economy of the kingdom, as well as development of the Saudi people by passing the know-how and expertise to Saudi nationals. Now, SAGIA has done a tremendous job and a wonderful one since it started. And it was ranked by the World Bank in its index in the year of 2010 for ease of doing business as number 11 in the world, which was an amazing achievement. SAGIA continues to be supportive of foreign investments in the kingdom. However, it seems that SAGIA has recently also became selective in terms of allowing the businesses that will only add value to the kingdom. SAGIA has a challenge to respect and adhere to the kingdom's commitments under the international treaties, including the World Trade Organization, which the kingdom became a member of in the year of 2005. At the same time, it cannot jeopardize the its economy and its business environment by opening it for all investors. So it has applied certain rules recently, which are right now the focus of foreign investors, and I think it's what triggered this interview.
Very good. Well, so SEGI just put together some new rules in connection with foreign investment activities involving construction and some other light industries. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what those rules are, maybe why they've put them together, and what it means if you're a foreign investor, somebody who's already there or somebody who's thinking about getting into the Saudi Arabia marketplace?
Okay. Now, SEGI as the regulator, in the past has applied many rules, and most of them were procedural in nature. So you had to go through a certain procedure to get your SAGIA license, and some of them were substantive. However, these rules in the past weren't that considered to be major for different foreign investors. Now SAGIA, since the year of 2012, has introduced a new governor, and specifically in May 2012. With the new governor, and it was expected, certain additional requirements, procedural and substantive, for SAGIA licenses were issued. Now, we assume the reason for the introduction of the new requirements and rules is the reason is there were cases of foreign investors where they came into the kingdom, and some of them did not comply with the laws and regulations in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Others did not participate in the economy because of, you know, the small size of the business, or some of them just got out of business in Saudi Arabia and were not successful. So as part of SAGIA's mission, they have to make access to the Saudi business market easy, but at the same time, they have to make sure that only the serious players will enter into the market. Now they applied the new rules, and the new rules are reflected clearly in the activity of contracting and construction, where now investors, both current and new investors, have to show and demonstrate to SAGIA and the Saudi government that they have added value. Now, this change is part of major changes and reforms that the kingdom has been going through. We've seen changes in the judiciary law. A new arbitration law was passed, and new laws on real estate finance and financial lease were passed. That regulates a real estate mortgage, and those laws have direct effect on foreign investments and on construction specifically.
Very good. Very interesting stuff. So I want to shift topics a little bit on this. I apologize. I've lost my place here. I'm just trying to find it. And talk to you a little bit more about what's going on with SAGIA. On the rules of contracting and construction. I guess we all know the Middle East is a big area, Jihad, for just overall construction in the last couple of decades. So tell us a little bit about this sector specifically and what it means for foreign construction contractors that are trying to get in the game.
Okay, Saudi Arabia is a growing country at a very fast rate and pace. Its economy is very strong, and it's among the strongest in the Middle East. As part of the growing economy, many projects are seen in the area of infrastructure and housing, which triggers a lot of interest from both national investors and international investors. Saudi Arabia also has a very growing population, and therefore we're seeing a lot of projects in infrastructure and housing, and I can give examples in let's say the airports in Saudi Arabia. There are several airports in the country that are either being built or renewed and renovated. We're also seeing rail projects. We have the North-South Rail Project. We have the Haramain, and Haramain being the two holy cities. We have the Riyadh Metro Project and the Jeddah Metro Project. Also, we have a housing project, which is a major one, adopted by the Ministry of Housing. And this is to make affordable housing accessible to the Saudi nationals. And this has triggered a lot of interest, and also the kingdom requires a lot of investors in the area of construction to help the country move forward and with these projects. Now, in terms of the new rules, I can highlight three main new rules in the area of construction and contracting that Saudi has applied for foreign investors. The first one being the business plan, a detailed business plan that has to be submitted to Saudi to convince the government that there is a serious business that's coming, and the effect of that business on the Saudization, or when Saudization being giving more jobs to the Saudi people and to the Saudi economy. So there must be a solid business plan that is submitted to the government, and the government will monitor that plan and see how it's implemented on the ground. The second requirement, which is also significant, is the 75% Saudization. So if you come into the kingdom and have your entity and have your business started and established in the kingdom, 75% of your employees and your labor force have to be Saudi nationals, and that's to afford and give Saudi nationals jobs and participate in building their own country. Now, the third requirement is the bank guarantee, which is basically a bond that has to be submitted to SAGIA with 2% of the minimum number of their activities, the minimum figure for the contracts and the activities that they are performing according to a certain classification by the Ministry of Rural Affairs. These requirements are a bit significant.
Jean, I'm going to have to cut you off there. Yeah. We're going to come back with more after this commercial break.
Okay.
Be sure to friend us on Facebook. You can do it right now. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America or search for us at keyword Voice America.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back, everyone. Well, it's been a busy couple of weeks at the Supreme Court as they finish up their year with a lot of very significant decisions. We're going to talk about one that hasn't gotten a lot of attention but matters to everyone here in the United States. Joining us to talk about it is Richard Oprell. He is a partner in the Patton Boggs Washington, D.C. office, somebody who's got a lot of experience in litigating complex federal cases, and he's done some work in the biotechnology field, and he's going to talk to us about a recent Supreme Court decision that regards the patentability of the human gene. So, Richard, welcome to the show, and I guess this matters because it raises the question of who owns me. Do I own me? Do I own my genes? And maybe talk to us a little bit about what the central holding of this case was and what it means for researchers and patients.
Certainly. Good afternoon, Kevin. This was a case that can end up having real significance not only for businesses but for people. Essentially, it involved a case where a company discovered a sequence of DNA, the famous double helix, and that particular part of DNA would indicate whether or not you had a likelihood of getting either breast cancer or ovarian cancer. And they discovered that when you have that DNA sequence, you are more likely to be later on found to have those diseases. So it was a significant discovery, because it means that you can create a test to look for that genetic sequence, and if you then find it, you can either take preventative action or be on the lookout with more frequent doctor's visits. This part of it was actually in the news recently because, as you may recall, Angelina Jolie was found to have this particular a DNA sequence called BRAC1 or 2, and she went ahead and had preventative surgery. So the two public events, the Supreme Court decision and the Angelina Jolie story, kind of dovetailed at about the same time. Who owns your DNA? Well, the Supreme Court definitely answered that question and said the DNA that is in your body, you own it, and a company that discovers a naturally occurring sequence or part of DNA, they are not going to be able to obtain a patent on that discovery, on that sequence as it exists in nature. And that's because under the patent laws of the United States, you can't patent a product of nature. So you can't go out and patent the grass.
Yeah, well, I've had my eye on this tree for quite a while that I wanted to patent. Richard, well, let me ask you about that. So what does this decision mean for existing patents, especially in the biotech field?
It's going to have varying impacts depending on what the technology is that has been patented. There are thousands, literally thousands, of these DNA sequence discovery patents, which have been allowed by other courts and by the Patent and Trademark Office for the last 30-some-odd years. And under this decision called Association for Molecular Pathology versus Myriad Genetics, those patents are in all likelihood invalid. So if I have if I've discovered a DNA sequence and I am using that DNA sequence, I've isolated, I've split out the rest of the DNA, and I'm using that as a test to test for that gene, for that genetic mutation, those patents are going to be invalid and unenforceable. Now, it gets very interesting because anything that is a product of nature can't be patented. But if somehow man gets involved and does something to it, the Supreme Court indicated that can be patented. So you can actually take DNA and from it create synthetic DNA, or what's called cDNA. And the Supreme Court indicated that because that was something that was made by man and is different from what you find in nature, that those patents are going to be found valid. But there are a whole host of technologies and inventions and methods of using something where it is going to be up to courts on a case-by-case basis to try to determine whether or not something is properly patentable or not.
So we talked about the existing patents. I guess the other big question is, what does it mean going forward? If you're a company that spent a lot of time in genetic research, is this now making you pull back on the desire to do that research because it's not going to be as valuable to you in the long term?
It may have some effect in that regard, but I think that there are ways to mitigate the impact. If you're spending money solely to do research to find the existence of DNA sequences, you are not going to be able to patent those. You are not going to be able to protect somebody, to protect against somebody else coming in and using those sequences by way of the patent laws. This is going to certainly help academics who are studying and who are writing about DNA sequencing. But what you will have to do when you are a company is you will no longer just be able to exclude based on a DNA sequence. You will have to take that DNA sequence that you discover and do something else with it. You will have to create a test using man-made inventions, not products of nature, that will let you say this isn't natural as it exists. It's nature plus something that man did to it. Therefore, we can patent that. Or we can patent a method of testing for something. Or we can take the DNA sequence, strip certain things, certain parts out of it, create brand new DNA that's made by man. And those should all be patentable under the new decision. My guess is you will still have companies in the biotech area that are going to continue to work in the area, but they and their lawyers are going to have to perhaps get a bit more creative than they've had to in the past on what it is that they're going to try and protect and how it is that they're going to try and protect what is always a significant in investment in this research area.
Interesting. Are there other challenges for genetics and products in general as a result of this decision?
Well, again, it does not answer the question directly of who actually, if you take a blood product from someone and use it in a test, and that is then made into some other product, this decision does not resolve potential ownership issues that would relate to a product that's covered for something like that. I mean, I think that any time that you have a natural product, a vitamin supplement that is solely found in nature, there are going to be an issue on whether or not you can have patent protection for that. So it's going to be a decision that could have ramifications beyond the world of genetics, but into natural foods or wholly natural drug type products.
Interesting. And are there any other implications like that that people need to be aware of as this decision echoes through the halls of power?
They're going to need to be thinking as they design research projects and as they move forward with research products, what it is that they are looking at, what it is that they publish along the way, and they will really need to be thinking creatively about, all right, if we discover this, what can we do to it in order to make sure that it falls on the patentability side of life, and that we actually capture a product or a method that somebody will not simply be able to come up behind us, piggyback on all of the expensive research and work that we've done, and have a product that competes. So this myriad decision answered some questions, but has raised a whole lot more. And as the Supreme Court does sometimes, seems to have made people's lives somewhat more complicated.
Gotcha, Richard. Hit people with your email address if they want to contact you for more information.
Sure. It's Richard Operil at patentbogs.com, R-O-P-A-R-I-L.
Great. We're going to be back in just a moment to talk about the state of student loan legislation in the Senate.
Thank you, Kevin.
Find out which guests are being featured this week. Read our network press releases and read the blog posts from your favorite hosts. Go to iradioblog.com today, powered by the Voice America Talk Radio Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patent Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patent Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patent Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patent Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patent Boggs, LLP.
Hola. Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Merhaba.
From Denver to Doha.
Ciao.
Patent Boggs makes business transactions the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patent Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patent Boggs.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patent Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patent Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, we're going to spend the rest of the show talking about a couple of hot issues up on Capitol Hill, one of which is the potential for student loan interest rates to double come July 1st. Joining us to talk about this important subject, Amy Budner-Smith and Dana Weeks, both folks that work in the education practice of the public policy group at Patton Boggs. Amy and Dana, welcome back to the show. Dana, let me ask, it sure seems like this is a repeat of what happened last year. Tell us what happened last year and explain to us, is this the exact same thing, or are there any differences at all?
Kevin, you're completely right. This is a repeat of last year, as Congress is addressing the same issue it confronted last year. As you may recall, Congress had passed a short-term fix to prevent the student loan interest rates from doubling from 3.4% to 6.8%, but that one-year fix expires on July 1st, only 5 days away. So now we're back on this issue, and if it isn't resolved by the deadline, then student loan interest rates will in fact double. So in this sense, we do have a feeling of deja vu. But what's starkly different about this year, I have to say, Kevin, is the initial disagreement over whether to have a short-term or long-term fix. You may remember that last year on the campaign trail, presidential candidate Mitt Romney had sided with President Obama that student loan interest rates should not double. This announcement was surprising to some, but most surprising to the Republican leadership in Congress who, in response to Mitt Romney's announcement, then went into action to help extend the 3.4% interest rate for 1 year. However, this year, Kevin, I think the conversation approach to addressing this issue is very different because Republicans are driving an agenda that Congress must find a long-term solution to the interest rate problem. Republicans have also had an extra chip in their pocket to force a conversation about a longer-term solution because President Obama had also proposed such a solution in his FY 2014 proposal. So, Kevin, although the same issue, hence deja vu, we are seeing a vastly different conversation from last year.
Interesting. Well, Amy, I know Republicans in the House are sort of beating their chest saying, not our problem, we have taken care of this. Tell us a little bit about what's happened in the House.
Yeah, sure, Kevin. The House actually passed a measure on May 23rd to reform student loan interest rates. That's the Smarter Solutions for Students Act, and it was introduced by House Education and the Workforce Committee Chairman John Klein of Minnesota. The measure is a long-term solution that would change how rates are calculated for all subsidized and unsubsidized Stafford loans by utilizing a new interest rate formula that's based on the 10-year Treasury note with an additional 2.5% for Stafford loans and an additional 4.5% for the graduate and the Parent PLUS loans. In order to win over Democrats in the House, the bill's authors included an 8.5% cap on interest rates for Stafford loans and a 10.5% cap on PLUS loan rates for parent loans. Since passage, and particularly over the last week, as you noted, House Republican leaders have really increased their pressure on Democrats in the Senate for failing to take action, while also blaming President Obama for his lack of leadership on the issue. They claim the House measure is very similar to the president's proposal, which, as Dana noted, appeared in his 2014 budget request. And while there are similarities, there are some key differences as well. The main difference and the basis for the White House's veto threat of the House bill is the fact that it does not lock in a rate on new loans, but would allow the rate to vary from year to year over the life of the loan, depending on the market.
Gotcha. Well, so tell me, ladies, exactly where the Senate is as we speak here on Thursday afternoon.
To be honest, Kevin, the Senate is basically at a stalemate despite attempts on both sides of the aisle to address this issue, and it doesn't look like the stalemate will be changing in the next 24 hours.
Yeah, well, and part of the reason for the stalemate in the Senate is that President Obama left the Democratic leadership hamstrung because he did call for a long-term solution in his budget proposal and put forth a proposal that had specific elements like no cap that put Democrats at odds with him. The cap issue really is non-negotiable for Democrats, something Senate Help Committee Chairman Tom Harkin just reiterated this morning. So the president's plan would also utilize the 10-year Treasury note to determine rates and would include smaller added percentages, so a plus 0.93% for subsidized Stafford loans, a plus 2.93% for unsubsidized Stafford loans, and a plus 3.93% for parent loans. As previously noted, the rate for new loans would be fixed over the life of the loan. And while the proposal does not include a cap, the administration insists that borrowers are protected through expanded repayment options offered for those who have already left school, which would really provide them with a little more flexibility to meet their financial obligations. In recent negotiations with Senate leaders, White House staff have indicated their willingness to accept a cap, though, if it would ultimately lead to a deal.
Go ahead, Dana.
Well, I was just going to say also, Kevin, as I had mentioned earlier, there have been unsuccessful attempts to get legislation passed on this issue. So earlier this month, the same week when the Senate considered the Farm Bill, there were two partisan bills that were unsuccessful at getting passed. The Republican bill, which was offered by Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma, it would have pegged the student loan interest rate to the 10-year Treasury note, which you'll see as a theme, the pegging a bill to the 10-year Treasury note, and would have added 3 percentage points to it with no cap, although the bill would have had a fixed interest rate for the life of the loan. And for this particular bill, only 40 senators, all Republicans except for Senator Tom Carper from Delaware, who is a Democrat, were in support of the bill. The Democratic bill, on the other hand, took a vastly different approach and also failed to get 60 votes. It only received 51 votes. And the legislation there would have created a 2-year extension of the current 3.4% interest rate. And actually, just this morning, we saw the release of another proposal from a bipartisan group. That group consists of Senators Lamar Alexander from Tennessee, who is the ranking member of the Senate Help Committee, Richard Burr of North Carolina, once again, Tom Coburn of Oklahoma, and then we have independent Angus King of Maine and Democrat Joe Manchin of West Virginia. For this proposal for undergraduate Stafford loans, both subsidized and unsubsidized, the bill would once again tie the rate of the loan to a 10-year Treasury borrowing rate and add 1.85%. As for the PLUS loans, it would add about 4.4%. But for both loans, the interest rate would be fixed for the life of the loan, and students would have the option to consolidate their loans as well as cap repayments at 8.25%. They say that this bill is expected to save about $1 billion over 10 years. However, Kevin, I've got to say for too many Senate Democrats, this bill is basically a non-starter because there is no interest rate cap on the front end, which Amy had alluded to earlier is a non-negotiable for Democrats.
Interesting. So obviously it sounds like everybody and their brother has a proposal and they're all flacking slightly different things. So I know some Senate Democrats were a little ticked off that the president put them in this position by having such an aggressive proposal in his budget and then the Republicans passing their own plan. Tell us what you think the likely outcome is since we're hard up against the July 1st date. My guess is that July 1st isn't that hard a date because most people aren't worried about student loans until school really starts back up in late August and September. But what do you think is going to happen here?
So I think neither the bipartisan proposals, so For example, in addition to the bipartisan proposal that was introduced today, there's another Democratic proposal out there from Senators Tom Harkin of Iowa, who is chairman of the Senate Health Committee, Jack Reed of Rhode Island, and Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts. Their proposal would actually peg the student loan interest rate to the 10-year Treasury rate and add about 1.5% for subsidized loans and 3.4% for unsubsidized loans. And their bill actually includes a cap, capping rates at 8.25%. And there should be more to follow about this particular proposal, which we expect to be introduced today as they're holding a press conference at 2 o'clock p.m. But to your point of what's likely to be the outcome here, we think that neither the bipartisan proposal nor the Democratic proposal is going to be enacted before the deadline. With the Senate scheduled to recess next week, whatever measure is considered will have to include now a retroactive fix for rates that double on July 1st.
That's right. And just to add to Dana's point, you know, I think we expect a measure that will have a rate cap at the end of the day. If it doesn't, it will have to ensure further protections to borrowers through some kind of increased repayment options as proposed by the president. And if senators manage to maintain, you know, in whatever compromise bill that does progress, the $1 billion or more in savings that were reported by the Congressional Budget Office for the bipartisan bill Dana spoke of released earlier today, I think the House would be hard-pressed to reject something like that. You know, while the CBO said the House proposal would save $3.6 billion over the same 10-year period, other analysts point to the economic impact of reducing student loan debt more generally, which, as you know, is now topped $1.1 trillion nationwide. And, you know, I think that's why getting this right is so important. The student loan debt crisis impacts other areas of our economy by delaying important life decisions for young adults, like getting married and, you know, buying a home or a car.
Interesting. Well, tell us, are there any, if you're a stakeholder, and that means anything from mom and dad, you know, trying to finance their son or daughter's education to universities to players in the financial markets, what are your key takeaways about this deal that may or may not take place in the near term here in Congress?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, at the end of the day, what our higher ed clients really want in this is more stability for their students. I think parents would say the same thing. They want to be able to know, you know, what the rules are going forward. And, you know, I think this really includes a long-term solution that is market-based for all stakeholders involved. We anticipate other issues related to student loans will need to be addressed during reauthorization of the Higher Education Act, not too far down the pike. And I think that includes repayment and refinancing options, as well as improve financial literacy education and loan counseling efforts. Dana, you might have some more thoughts on that.
Yeah, and you know, if universities do have thoughts on these issues, and all other organizations and stakeholders, as we've seen, the National Student Council presidents were recently on the Hill advocating on this issue, they should consider including it in their response to the House Education, the Workforce Committee's call for comments. These kind of issues that are outside of the discussion right now, as Amy mentioned, financial literacy or repayment and refinancing options, because Congress will let interest rates double and a retroactive fix will be needed, we think those colleges and universities that have not weighed in should already do so because there is some time left. And they should honestly speak directly to a few things. One would be whether a proposal should have a cap on rates, and if so, what should be the cap. They also should speak out and speak directly to whether to include a variable or fixed rate, and then also what the plus-up percentages should be. I think if they also focus conversations on these three issues, it will be fruitful and really inform the discussion as Congress looks at a retroactive fix.
Very good. Well, ladies, wanted to give everyone your contact information if they want more details from you.
Sure. This is Amy. You can get me at abudnersmith@pattenboggs.com.
And this is Dana, and you can get me at dweeks@pattenboggs.com, and that's D-W-E-E-K-E-S.
Terrific. Well, we're going to be back in just a minute to talk about the status of immigration reform in the United States Senate and House of Representatives. Keep it here for more Capital Thinking.
Your favorite Voice America Talk Radio Network shows and hosts are in your car, outdoors, and wherever you need them to be.
Listen anywhere.
Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs. A bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, it's been a big week for immigration reform. We're joined by Sam Mudrick, an associate in Patton Boggs' Washington, D.C. office, who does some work in this space to talk a little bit about what's happening on the Hill and what the Supreme Court decisions of this week have to do with the battle over immigration reform. Sam, welcome to the show, and why don't you get us caught up on where things stand here on a Thursday afternoon.
Thanks, Kevin. It's a pleasure to be here. It's an exciting time in Congress right now with immigration. In fact, if you're a poli-sci student out there, you should pay close attention. You'll learn a lot about the ins and outs, not only of the legislative process, but also a healthy dose of politics that's coming through in the House in the near future. In fact, we actually, what I tell you right now on the show might become obsolete by the time the show's over, because the final version of the Senate immigration bill, S-744, is coming up for a vote this evening. At 4 o'clock, there will be a roll call for the final vote, and Majority Leader Reid's actually asked for all 100 senators to be present for the vote, which is a pretty rare request and shows the importance that he and the Democrats see for this issue and this bill. The vote is looking like it's going to come out just under the 70 votes that the Democrats are looking for, although it's possible they do reach it. Over the last couple weeks, the Democrats have been working with Republicans in the Senate to come up with some amendments that would strengthen their ability to raise the number of votes to reach the 70, which Democrats believe will give them some momentum going into the House. And although this bill likely won't be brought up in the House, it would at least allow Democrats there to call on their Republican counterparts and give House Leader Boehner some ground to call on a comprehensive reform and help get some of the Republicans in the House moving towards a comprehensive solution instead of just a piecemeal solution.
What do you see as the next step?
The next step in the House is a different beast. So right now the Senate bill is done. There's been no more amendments. We assume it's going to pass this afternoon.
It's only a question of how big the margin.
Exactly. So really how much of you know, bragging rights and pressure can the Democrats push on the Republicans in the House. In the House, it's different. We all know that the Romney loss last year included some historic lows in Hispanic votes for Republicans, which at least was in part due to the conservative immigration stances he took starting in the Republican primary. We all remember his self-deportation comments, and it wasn't taken very well in the Hispanic community. With Hispanic demographics growing and them being seen as one of the more important minority voting blocks in the future, although some argue whether or not that's really they are that important, they are something that the Romney loss was something that the Republicans took rather hardly and pushed them to at least look at comprehensive immigration reform. However, interestingly, some argue that the Supreme Court's Voting Rights Act ruling this week to remove various preclearance requirements could actually disincentivize some of the House Republicans who had leaned towards some of the compromise on the immigration bill because the effects of the ruling could alleviate some political pressure GOP is facing to attract more Latino votes. It still remains to be seen what the actual effect will be, but it's an interesting thing to look at into the future. But in the House generally, as opposed to the Senate, members are more interested in their own district-specific demographics and issues given their two-year terms, the fact that they're beholden to much smaller and narrowly drawn districts, so they don't need to vote for a comprehensive bill in order to re-win their elections. So they're going to be less likely to favor a grand immigration scheme if it could hurt them back home. And that gives Boehner some real difficulties moving forward, trying to convince enough Republicans in the House to support a bill that would actually be looked at by the Senate Democrats, because currently they have a two-track process going on in the House. The House Gang of Seven, which used to be eight, but now is seven since Representative Labrador left the group over a fight about health care coverage. They are moving forward drafting a comprehensive bill, but it still hasn't been introduced. We expect that will probably come out within the next week or two. But House Judiciary Chair Bob Goodlatte of Virginia has been active for the last month debating and marking up and passing a number of piecemeal or topical immigration bills before the House Judiciary Committee, because he argues that it provides more debate and inspection of the actual bills themselves. So Goodlatte, although he's been saying all along he really wants to do piecemeal, he at least recently was saying he would consider a bipartisan bill if it comes about. But it also is possible that they would use the Group of Seven bill when it comes out to actually amend the other piecemeal bills and come together with the group at the end. So it's really not clear what's going to happen there, but that's really where the excitement's going to come in the next month.
Sam, so a lot has been made of the drubbing that President Obama gave Mitt Romney in the 2012 election, in particular amongst the Hispanic sector of the population, and how Republicans needed to do immigration reform in part to build a relationship with that sector and remain relevant in national elections. Do you think it seems to me like Senate Republicans have responded to that urgency, and that's why you're going to get somewhere in the neighborhood of 12 to 20 of them voting this afternoon to pass the immigration bill? But what about the House Republicans?
Yeah, I think initially we heard a lot more out of the House Republicans, particularly the leadership, saying that yes, we do need to move forward. You know, there's some voices calling for comprehensive reform, but that's really sort of petered out in the last month in particular, as the bills are coming forward in the House Judiciary Committee, and as we're seeing the language, it's a lot more conservative than anything that could really be passed by Congress as a whole. So I think the pressures in the House are just so different that Boehner's really got his hands full, that he's going to be working hard to try and rally support for a bill that can actually pass Congress and get to the president's desk, as opposed to just some of the bills that are coming out now or some of the language and rhetoric we're hearing out of some House Republicans, which is a little more conservative and wouldn't actually bring about comprehensive reform.
Gotcha. Well, talk to me a little bit about the Supreme Court decision yesterday, basically invalidating several provisions of the Defense of Marriage Act, ruling them unconstitutional. What sort of impact does that have on the immigration debate that's pending in the House and Senate?
The important part of the ruling for immigration is that the Supreme Court held that Section 3 of DOMA is unconstitutional, and that was the section that limited federal recognition of marriages to those just between a man and a woman. Now, immigration law is exclusively federal. So the old DOMA meant that no same-sex marriages, no matter where contracted, could be recognized for immigration purposes. As a little background, the general rule in immigration law is that the government will recognize a marriage as long as it was legal in the location where it was contracted. There are a few public policy exceptions to this, such as polygamy, and previously DOMA was another exception which ruled out same-sex marriages. So, for example, I had a client who was applying for a green card based on a marriage to his first cousin in California. But because first cousin marriages are legal in California, he was able to get his green card. Had he gotten married in a state where first cousin marriages were not legal, he would not have qualified for the green card. That's an important distinction to make, and that was a different sex couple. They weren't same-sex couple. And that's an important distinction because it's the location and the legality of the marriage that matters for immigration purposes, not the location where the married couple ends up living in the U.S. So striking down DOMA means that the U.S. government will now look at all applications under its old rule, which is, was the marriage valid under the law of the state or country where it was entered into? So if a same-sex couple marries in New York or New Zealand where same-sex marriages are legal and then move to a U.S. state where it is not legal when they apply for their green card, they will still qualify since federal law controls for immigration purposes. So as long as your same-sex marriage is legal, you will be able to apply anywhere in the United States for your immigration benefits. And what this means practically is that there are thousands of same-sex couples that can now apply for immigration benefits for their spouses, including a number of couples who left the United States due to their inability to petition for their spouse that can now return. And politically, strategically, it's a very interesting point because Senator Leahy was poised to include a same-sex amendment in his current Senate bill, chose not to do so since Republicans feared that it would kill the bill. And even many pro-LGBT Democrats like Barney Frank saw the DOMA case on the horizon as an external fix and told him to hold off, which he did, and which ended up being a very smart political move.
Well, I got about 2 minutes left. Stare into your crystal ball, Sam, and tell me how this all works out in the next few months.
Well, I can tell you, the real work's going to be in the House. Obviously, Senate's done. Timing-wise, you know, with the two-track process in the House, it's going to be tough for the House to have anything done before the August recess, but it's possible if they can push. Goodlatte's making good progress on the piecemeal bills, so those could be brought up. They've passed several. Right now, one of the Skills Act, one of the other ones, is on the floor being marked up today. But the possibility is also that the Gang of Seven, when their bill comes in, which we believe will be in the next few weeks at least, will slow things down because they'll want to have hearings and markups on that, and it's just a larger, more comprehensive bill. So, you know, they could do several more hearings in July, markups by mid-July, but we all know that the recess is coming up in August, and so they could squeeze something in last week of July before the recess, but you're really talking maybe a 50-50 chance. So there's a good chance that it's going to be brought back in September and something will be finished in the House sometime in September or early October.
All right, hit everyone up with your contact information, Sam.
Sure. I'm S. Mudrick, M-U-D-R-I-C-K, at patentbogs.com.
Great. That's going to do it for this week's Capital Thinking. Everyone have a terrific weekend. We'll see you next week back here with more Capital Thinking.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.